close the wall up with our English stead. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we are live and in living silliness.
Hopefully.
On this Saturday, July 16th, 2016.
All day.
Yes.
We hope. That's the date all day, hopefully.
So it's the date all day, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it all depends on where you are.
If it's not the date all day, on another day, it might be somewhere else.
Yes, you may
Or it may be today, but a different date.
Yes.
Because there's this roving line of confusion.
If you were over on the other side of the international date line, it would not be July 16th all day.
You would think that the international date line would be something associated with Tinder or Match.com or some other dating site. But no, it isn't. They don't have a line for that. I don't know why. Instead, it's just something to confuse our calendars and our clocks on a regular basis.
Yeah, but without it, it wouldn't work.
So you're saying that the only way that our system of time works is by adding confusion.
Got it.
All right. Sounds good to me.
Like,
sounds like our program. Actually,
the assumption in saying what time it is that you know where you are.
Because yes.
Where you are determines what time it is.
Right.
And it's weird. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And if today is July 16th and you happen to be somewhere in the United States of America or some similar place on this side of the dateline, there's some depth in that one too. You're certainly welcome to give us a call. Our telephone number is 254-773-1400.
And we actually answer that number, and we will talk to you. Strange, I know. Mm-hmm.
So,
but we have a disclosure to give before we get into the meat of the show. We're going to get into the vegetables first.
The Personal Wealth Coach is not just the name of a radio program. It's also the name of an investment advisory firm. Located in Salado, Texas, and registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. Yeah. That's a disclosure.
Well done.
So what else? What do we want to talk about? Anything interesting happen?
Well, we usually begin by talking about something interesting happening and then talking about the fact that a week has passed. But in this particular case, since the last time we were live on the air, more than a week has passed. Quite a lot of weeks have passed for multiple reasons, but time goes on.
Well,
so a lot of things have taken place since our last episode.
The reason a lot of weeks has passed is because the Earth has fortunately continued in its route around the sun on a radius of about 93 million miles.
There you go on again about momentum.
Yes, yes.
It's the true momentum investing, and that is that the Earth continues to turn and we get new choices every day.
Well, this week, again, the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the Standard & Poor's 500 Stock Index hit all-time records. Which
for being down or for being up?
All-time records on the upside. I don't think they're likely to hit the downside.
No. I think the all-time record is 10 on the downside.
Yes.
And I don't believe it goes below that.
And at least part of that was because of bulls who are normally vegetarians becoming carnivores as they ate bear meat.
So the bulls were eating bears.
Yes. What happened is one of the reasons that the market keeps bumping up against and going to highs somewhat higher than analysts expected, as it turns out, is that there were a pretty substantial number of people who thought the markets would react negatively to the news and information that it's getting, and they thought it was going to go down. And they said lots of good reasons that the market should go down. The price of oil dropped again.
Oh, yes.
There was, you know, attacks in Nice. You go down the list of all the things that historically have caused the market to drop.
Interest rates in the United States on long-term U.S. Treasuries are very, very low. That's usually
record low.
It usually is bad news. In this case, it's not.
And all the bears were all ready for that, and they shorted the market, which is to say they sold a bunch of stocks that they didn't own, anticipating that they could buy them back at a lower price. And then the bulls came in.
Can I explain that for just a second? Because I think most of our listeners hear us say things like they shorted the market, which means they sold shares they didn't own, and people go, what? How can you do that?
You borrow them.
Yes. And what happens is a very normal practice for people in the market, not people that are, in my opinion, completely sane, but it's a normal practice for people to literally bet against the market by borrowing someone else's shares for a price and selling them with the expectation that the market's going to drop and they'll be able to repay those shares to the person they borrowed them from by buying them at a lower price.
That's one of the ways, by the way, that brokerage firms make money. When you when you own stocks or mutual funds or whatever, the actual shares are held by a brokerage firm and are the property of the brokerage firm, which is why you should be concerned about whether or not the brokerage firm will go out of business and if it's covered by insurance.
All that good stuff.
But they then will rent those shares out that they owe you, and they get interest on the shares they rent out, and that's called short interest.
Yes.
So if we measure short interest, it's how much, basically, it's how much money are the brokerage firms making from
people borrowing
stocks and paying interest on them. And the higher the short interest, the more likely the market is to go up, because it's not a matter you can borrow the stocks and you just keep them forever.
There's a time limit.
Yeah. Well, first off, that, and it costs money to have that stock out there.
It's like any other loan.
And then when the market starts up, when you expected it to go down, that means A, you now have to buy that stock back and replace the one that you sold at a higher price, which means you've got a loss. And the longer you hold in a short position, the more interest it costs you.
Right. So as that number, the short interest, goes up, the closer we get to a known event where those people that are betting against the market have to buy the market to make it go up. They don't want to do that, but that's what happens.
And, once they start buying shares to replace whoever starts buying shares, to replace the ones they borrowed because the market had risen, the fact that they're buying makes the market rise even further, which causes others to start buying to replace the shares they borrowed. Yes. And what you get
is a panicked buy.
Yeah, it's called a short panic, and it really doesn't last very long.
No.
But the issue is that the market will, for no particular economic reason, suddenly shoot up as the bears get eaten by the bulls.
Right.
Which is why I referred to the fact that the bulls were eating bear meat.
Yeah. So what we have in the last week is an example of an upward crash. How's that for
making your brain go inside out for a second? An upward panic, I would call it.
Right. I would say so. But it was crashing for the people that were doing the buying because they were losing money by buying.
Mm.
It's very confusing, and this is why we look at people that do this. If there's multiple ways of investing. If you buy something because you expect it to make something of value that other people are willing to pay for, and long term you decide this is a good thing, it's going to make me money because they're creating value that people are paying for, this is a good thing. Nobody has to lose money for you to make money. In fact, everybody makes money if you make money, and that the people that are buying things from that company are only buying it because they feel like it's a good deal. So if you're involved in a long-term investment that's making money by creating value, everybody involved in that transaction makes money. Now, if you're betting against the market, if you're borrowing and selling and then trying to buy back in, the only way you make money is if someone else is losing money, and vice versa. In order for somebody else to win in that kind of a bet environment, somebody has to lose. It's like playing poker. There's only so much money on the table in the short world.
And there's some good news about this record high, which equates to, there's some bad news that equates to good news.
Oh, it's just as confusing as everything else we've been talking about so far.
The pessimists are saying this is artificial, it's going to collapse. There's no reason for the market to be up except some technical issues. And so it's going to go back down. And the general public who own mutual funds and 401ks and things like that have been redeeming shares far more than they've been buying shares in their mutual funds and ETFs, which means that the general public is convinced the market is headed down. The pessimists, the bears, are convinced the market is heading down and are very vocal about it.
Right.
And as long as you have a lot of people who are convinced the market is going to go down, it will go up.
Yes.
Because
the bad news that is actually good news.
And it's just the nature of the game, because those people who are convinced the market is, quote, going, end quote, down, are going to sell out and or have sold out. And the people who are buying, once the market starts actually rising, because people are buying, eventually those people who have all this cash sitting on the side are going to look at this and say, whoops.
I need to get back in there.
I need to get back in there. And we have not seen the masses stampede back into the market, either on the professional side or the public side. And that means we haven't really gotten seriously into a bull market yet,
right,
despite the fact we're hitting record highs.
This is where a great quote comes in. John Templeton said a lot of really good things. I've got most of my favorite market-related quotes come from him. Bull markets climb a wall of worry. It is something you can look back throughout history. And if you look at the headlines, if you look at the loudest proponents, if they're negative, if they're saying the market's about to crash, that's a really good indicator that the market's going to climb. And vice versa. If everybody is saying the market's going to go up forever, then it's probably a good time to distance yourself from the market.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a psychological component there. If a large population of people really seriously believe that the market is going down or is about to go down, what are they going to do about it? Well, they're going to sell because they don't want to be part of the market going down. If they really strongly believe that the market's about to go down, they've already sold. Which means that if there's a lot of people saying the market's about to go down, they're already out of the market. The pessimists have already left. And that leaves people buying. And this is a very gross simplification, but it's an understandable simplification. When people say the market is going to go up forever for whatever reason, and if you go back to 2006, 2007, or you go back to the year 2000 at the beginning of the year, and you look at headlines or you listen to recorded news broadcasts, you'll hear anchors saying things like, I'm ready to retire today, that sort of thing, means that you should expect a crash. That when everyone agrees that the market's going up, it's going to go down. And when everyone agrees that the market's going to go down, it goes up. Because if you all agree, then you're already out. And that only leaves buying. If you all agree that it's going to go up, then you've already bought. And that means that there's nobody left to buy. And that's what causes the price to go up. If the people that are pessimistic have already sold, it just leaves the semi-optimists or just the pragmatists that say, hey, I've got to retire eventually. I better put some money away and just be long-term about it. And that's the psychological impact of the good news that is disguised as bad news.
Well, there's some other things there.
Yes.
70% of the United States economy, of the GDP, is composed of consumer spending, which a lot of people who really don't understand economics very well bemoan that and say it should be exports instead.
If we're exporting, it means somebody else is buying
it.
If somebody else is buying it, what are they doing with it? If they're just building something that somebody else is going to buy, that's what is known as a Ponzi scheme.
Well, but the big issue
if they're doing it to make something that people are going to buy and use,
mm-hmm.
that's the usefulness. That's consumption.
Let's just say we were like Germany and 50% of our GDP was based on exports. Our economy would be in the pits right now. And the reason
just
is
like Germany's is
the rest of the world is in a big hurt and they're not buying much in the United, because we sell to consumers in the United States mainly. We are in this interesting position where we can be pretty much a self-sustaining economy. We're not certainly not a completely self-sustaining economy, but the rest of the world can be in some degree of recession. And the United States do just fine.
And, there's
that's basically what's going on right now.
Yeah, there's actually a growth component in us not being in a recession while everyone else is,
mm-hmm.
because their prices come down on the things that we buy from them.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it harder for us to sell things to them, but it makes it easier for us to buy things. Which means that if we're buying things overseas and selling things internally, we're keeping the value of the things that we're purchasing here. And it's a little bit weird there, but that's a good component. There are a lot of friction components that get in there too when the rest of the world is in a recession and we're trying to drag them out of it by buying things from them and by being productive. It means that we have to work extra hard, but we also get to reap more of the benefit of extra work than anybody else is reaping.
And for those who, another thing people worried about a lot is industrial production in the United States.
Yeah. And we just have good news on that, too.
If you're a pessimist, you say, oh, no, employment in the industrial world is not good in the United States. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that on an annualized basis, industrial production in the United States is rising at about 8% a year.
Yeah.
Which is really good. And most of that stuff that we're manufacturing is being sold in the United States. And this is despite the fact that a big component of industrial production was, in the recent past, has been manufacturing big chunks of steel for various things to use in the oil patch that is no longer being bought because there's a bunch of empty rigs, although the rig count is up.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Rig count is up. Now, there's a...
But they're not buying new rigs because there's plenty of spare ones sitting around.
The number of rigs being used for oil production is up. We've talked about this in the past, but it's been long enough that we should probably remind you. Technology is increasing exponentially in the oil patch area. You can do this year with one rig what it took a rig and a half to do just a year ago.
Now wait.
And
wait,
next year it's likely to be one rig will do three rigs jobs from last
I
year.
Have seen a lot of oil fields.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never seen a half rig.
You just close one of your eyes.
So
just close one eye and it'll be fine.
If I were to see one and a half rigs out there that's been replaced by one rig.
Right. Well, this statistic is brought to you by the Census Bureau. Where the average person in the United States has 2.1 children.
Then wait a minute. It's the Census Bureau.
Oh, the Census Bureau. There we go. So rig count, when you're talking about big numbers, yes, you have fractional rigs on fields that don't exist.
Oh, that's what fracking's about.
Right. It's really fractional rigs. Thank you to the Census Bureau.
And you can have a fractional ownership in a rig.
Not the Censor Bureau. They're the ones that say beep when you say bad words.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So fractional fracking rigs.
Fractional ownership of fracking rigs.
Yes. The statistics.
That are fractionally better than they were last year.
Right. The statistics say that the fractional fracking rig count is up over last year.
That's right. But not by much.
Not by much.
Like six.
Right.
But the point I wanted to make, and I think the important thing is, despite the fact that a major chunk of last year's, for example, industrial production involved making heavy equipment to be used to punch holes in the ground out of which oil would be sucked.
I'm not sure that punch is the right word. Maybe blow holes in the ground.
Well, whatever they were doing, they were making the ground holy.
Spray holes.
That is largely gone away, and yet our industrial production is rising, which indicates that the rest of the industrial production in the United States is
kicking into high gear
to overcome this big deficit in oil rig production, which is extremely healthy in the large, small, and every other sector out there. You know, that's just part of the good. And it is an interesting. There's a whole series of things that we're saying here. Consumer spending is up. The oil rig count is starting to rise again. Industrial production is up. We'll go into some more detail.
Yeah, let me get some details. Throw those in there. Automotive production for June is up 5.9%.
Right.
We've got...
They had to replace that Tesla.
Yeah, that Tesla, that one Tesla had to be... No, I think it was more than that. I believe there are more cars being purchased than the one.
Actually, I just heard somebody a few moments ago say, we're going truck shopping.
Right, exactly. And it's not the only person doing it.
That's one of those powerful economic indicators that ought to be on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Person at KTEM says, I'm going truck shopping.
Computer, electronics, and appliances increased 1.5%. Those are appliances that are electronically related, like printers, things that So there was not a big boom there, but when we're looking at...
you don't want your electronic equipment to go boom.
It's like, we're having a boom in electronic equipment, and the reason why we're having the boom is because the electronics went boom,
so
we have to get more. No, we don't want that.
Yeah, Dell had one of its computers go boom.
And for a while, their output went down. So having a boom in electronics is not good.
And it's what we're seeing across the board is... In the areas that are most important in the economy, and we'll go into some more detail on this, but we're seeing growth in activity, growth in revenues, and despite the fact that the corporate revenues and corporate profits year over year are in a position right now where they have fallen last quarter about 4%. How can the market, if corporate profits are down 4%, how the heck is the market making new all-time highs? And the answer is, the market's not really priced on what happened last quarter.
It's happened
It's
now.
Priced on what they think is going to happen next quarter.
Right. Now, the estimates that are given today about next quarter are what causes the market to change value. If somebody says 3 years ago somebody didn't make money, it really doesn't affect their price today. So keep that in mind as well. There's another piece here that sounds like a detail, but it's one of those pieces that if you don't understand that it's actually a fundamental piece of the economy, just a little detail that's off to the side.
Is it a retail detail?
No, it's an industrial detail.
Oh, okay.
Retail details are much more fun to say, though. The industrial capacity, what usage we are making of our industrial facilities to create things is up as far as how much we're utilizing. We're at 75.4% of capacity. Okay, that's kind of a nice number. We still have somewhere around 25% capacity to go to if we need to grow. But you can't get there. Here's the good news to that piece of information, the piece that's really hard to find in the Federal Reserve reports, if for those of you that dig through Federal Reserve reports, because it's not in there. You have to go elsewhere. And that is that our capacity is growing, which means going up to 75.4% at the same time that the overall number is bigger means that we grew a lot more than it looked like. The reason why our capacity is going up is we're using the same facility. Ford's making a big deal out of not laying people off, but adding robots so that the people that are there can do a lot more. They're increasing their capacity, not by laying people off and replacing them with robots, but by putting robots in there that follow the people around and lift things for them and move things around for them. Our capacity is increasing, and that's one tiny example of the capacity increase. It's everywhere.
It brings me to something I want to talk about either this hour or next hour. Deep learning software.
Right. Machine learning, deep learning, yeah.
Which is actually practical artificial intelligence.
Right.
And people don't even realize they're using it.
That's exactly this example. Ford has machines that are following around its workers. And the workers are able to train the machines by doing their tasks, by taking the machine's hand and doing what they would do with their hand. And by hand, I mean they actually have the same gloves that the workers are using on a mechanical hand.
Are they white gloves that are kind of rolled up with three fingers and a thumb?
No,
like
that
a
would
Mickey
be
Mouse glove.
No, that's not. No, they are. They look like gardening gloves. So sorry, Mickey Mouse is not involved.
They really. If you're going to do this right, they should be white. They should be rolled up at the cuffs.
Right,
and they should have
little buttons on the knuckles too.
And they should be missing the little finger.
Right. And that's not the case in this instance, but across the board, if you're talking about new industrial facilities, if you're talking about existing industrial facilities, these are the ones that have taken the longest to change, these big plants that are huge plants. Sometimes they've got billions of dollars invested into them. And that means that those big machines take a long time to be replaced, except we're not replacing those machines. We're adding lots of little machines to move around them.
And this is a little irony in that.
Because they're made of iron? Is that
No. The Wall Street Journal and others have surveyed business leaders because despite what you're saying, which is true, with plans to do more investing, across the board, what the surveys are finding is that CEOs are deferring that industrial invest, the long-term investing, until after they figure out who's going to be president.
Yes.
And I'm going to be
a lot of that going on.
This sounds political, but it's just factual. When they're asked why, their answer is they think Donald Trump has a credible chance of becoming president of the United States. And if he were to do what he said, he would be starting major trade wars with the suppliers that these manufacturers need to utilize the equipment that they want to need. So they're hesitant, and they're really hesitant to buy equipment when we could be a year from now in a trade war.
Right, and it's not just Donald Trump. So this is why when it says sounds political, the CEOs and the major purchasing decision makers are also looking at Hillary Clinton in the same view. They're using the same lens because she's in direct talks now with Bernie Sanders, who has the same viewpoints on free trade agreements and so on. If we lower our free trade, it means our industrial capacity is going to go nowhere. I mean, we're not going...
Well, the capacity will stay there with the utilization will drop.
Well, what I mean is they have to get rid of equipment eventually. They're going to shut down the plants if we can't continue to sell at a way that allows us to compete in another country against the natives there.
It's not... The big issue, at least my understanding of it, is that there are a lot of components that industrial assemblers use in the United States that are manufactured, for example, in China.
Or Mexico.
Or Mexico. They constitute imports. But there's literally an insufficient number of workers in the United States to make those things. There's no way in the world we could make them.
Not right now.
You know, barring massive advances, which eventually I think we'll get to.
Yeah, yeah. We're doing that. It's just gradual.
Right. But the point is that if we were to start, if we were to impose, for instance, tariffs on imports from China and Mexico, what we would do is put our manufacturers in a tremendous disadvantage because, very simply, they would have to raise their prices dramatically, and as they raise their prices because the stuff they're importing that they assemble to make something would no longer be profitable. They'd have to raise the prices, which would cause the American consumer to stop buying those items, which would cause their earnings to fall, and they would start laying people off, which would create less money available to buy stuff, which is why economists and major business leaders, to the best of my knowledge, I've not found a single one that disagrees with this. If Donald Trump were elected, they expect a recession.
Right, and they're unsure what to expect with Hillary Clinton. So unsurety and expectations of things that are negative cause people to be delaying going forward. Now let me give you another piece of the foundation here, so it doesn't sound like we're nitpicking at Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, because they're holding views that a lot of other people hold.
Well, let me throw one other thing in here.
Okay.
The election of Ronald Reagan did generate a recession.
Yeah, absolutely. And
he had full intent, malice aforethought of doing that.
Right, and it wound up being one of the best things that we could do for the country, and it caused the boom that came afterwards, but we had to have a recession first. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about free trade, this is something that a lot of people get confused about. They figure out, why is it that we think it's important that there shouldn't be extra costs to import something? Why wouldn't we prefer to buy it by American? And the answer to that comes in kind of a roundabout way. And I'm going to go with a French mentality, because this is most of the people that say buy American don't really have a high opinion of the French economic perspective. It's a good example. The French, in an effort to cause higher employment, have said that there is a cap on the number of hours that any employee is allowed to work, or the employer gets a big fine. And they say, well, this is going to cause the employers to hire other French people to come in and do the jobs that they're not allowed to keep their current employees doing. it has the opposite effect. It causes the profits to drop and the people who are working there to work less hours rather than more hours. It causes unemployment to rise.
And it causes companies to leave France and go do business someplace else.
Right. And so when you think about if there's a governmental organization that's getting involved in a profit decision by saying we're going to impose a restriction that's going to make it more expensive to do something so that you will do something less expensive, like having somehow hiring people in the United States to build the equipment that's being built right now in China or in Mexico. We don't have the facilities, the investment that needs to create those facilities is a long process.
And we don't have the ability, we don't have the employees.
Right.
There's
exactly.
Even at the low skill level. First off, there's been an ongoing issue,
particularly at the low skill,
that's well documented, that employers are unable to expand. Companies are unable to expand in the United States because they can't find enough high-skilled workers. Well, previously, we had low-skill workers, but there have been several major reports in the Beige Book, which is what the Federal Reserve produces from its various regions, that employers in New England and several other places are reporting a cap on their ability to earn because they can't find enough low-skilled workers. In other words,
low-skilled.
At restaurants, for example, restaurant usage growth has been going up very fast as people feel more confident economically. The problem is, and you may find this as well locally if you go someplace, is that at the peak hours in the evening when they really need, when they make their money and everything is optimal, they can't find enough wait staff or cooking staff.
Or dish staff.
Or dish staff or whatever, dish staff, whatever, to do the work. And the same thing is starting to happen in other areas where physical labor is required. Like one of the reasons, as it turns out, I just discovered, that the construction work on I-35 through Central Texas is running so far behind schedule is James Construction, which has only so much money from the federal government to build highways, cannot find enough workers to fill all the positions, even though they pay pretty well. They pay on the federal wage scale, and they do all kinds they have to, all the things they have to do. But they can't find enough workers. They're actually operating at about 80% of desired number of workers. And two things are contributing to that. One, there's just a shortage of people who are willing to work because they're all doing other things. The job market is filled up. The other issue, of course, is the anti-illegal immigration movement has worked very well.
Very well.
And as a result, James Construction is under some severe constraints as to, so they have to validate the legality of the residency of everybody they hire. And as a result, previously they would fill that extra 20% with people who had really good-looking paperwork.
But it wasn't real.
But weren't really supposed to be here. And so we're paying the price for it.
Now let me give you the good news on all of that. And we've just said why trade wars are bad, why it is that we don't have the capacity to create the items that are being made in China and made in Taiwan and made in Thailand and made in Mexico for our industrial facilities. The good news is that we're taking that back. Our industrial capacity is now higher than it has ever been in the history of the United States. We have exported a lot of jobs, and we're not bringing the jobs back, and neither would a trade war. We're going to replace those jobs with machines. That's the way this trend works. And so having a trade war will not create employment. It will create machines.
We need to break for commercials.
Right. So let the market handle it is what I'm saying. The market's already doing it. We're bringing the capacity back. If government gets involved to try to create an environment where we are yanking things back from overseas, it's just going to get in the way. And now we let the market handle it.
let the market handle the commercials, too.
And yes, that's good.
We're about to play some commercials. We have no idea what they're going to be, and we do not necessarily endorse any of them at the Personal Wealth Coach. So we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. We'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we have a caller on 773-1400 as if there could be some other telephone number that could be on. And caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a poor, hardworking, unappreciated immigrant, and I have three questions.
Right.
You guys are interest. You guys favor value investment instead of growth and other things. What's your rationale? Number two, you talk about insurance products, annuities, fixed income. But what about variable annuities?
You're a pretty sophisticated, poor, hardworking immigrant.
Yes.
No, you missed the word unappreciated.
Unappreciated.
Oh, unappreciated.
Well, I appreciate your sophistication.
Yeah,
How's that?
You've asked a couple of very good questions.
Wait, you said three questions and you've only listed two.
You know, I've been hitting the bottle too hard, so I forgot the third question, so I'm going to make up for that. And that is, when you go for investment with a company that manages your accounts, what is the what's the standard? I mean, how much should I pay for that? Is it 5% too high? Is it 0.3% too low? What is the industry standard for that?
You are an amazingly astute, hardworking, unappreciated immigrant.
Yes.
Poor immigrant.
Poor.
I forgot about the poor. Yeah.
You guys are also hitting the bottle, I think, too hard.
I can't remember what I was saying a minute
ago. We don't go around hitting bottles. I've tried that. It's hard on my knuckles.
More like the bottle hits us sometimes.
Okay, all right. I'm going to hang up, and I'm going to jump into a shower while you give the answer to that.
May I make a suggestion?
Takes place.
I make a suggestion?
Yes, sir. Step
very carefully into the shower, because you jump into the shower, you're liable to slip and fall, and then you will understand insurance and liability and all of that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Listen, I'm going to turn the radio on so that I can listen to you guys, and thank you for your help.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
All right. Do you want to handle the variable annuity question, the value versus growth question, or the what is an appropriate cost for doing transactions in the financial world?
Is this guy a ringer or what?
I wish we would have written these questions down and had somebody call in for this.
Let's talk about value versus growth.
That's a good one to start with.
That's the most fundamental question he asked. Fundamentally, and I mean this with all sincerity, if you buy something below its natural intrinsic value, and you got to figure out what that number means, by the way, but if you buy a piece of real estate or a stock, or which is an interest in a operating company, and you look at the actual market value and you are able to buy it below that market value, it's a very simple proposition that your probability of being able to sell it later at a higher price is much better than if you buy it at above its current intrinsic value in the hope that it will rise higher.
Right.
One is historically a good way to invest. The other one is based on the greater fool theory. I know I'm paying too much for this stock or this real estate or whatever, or this residence, but I think that there is a greater fool out there who will pay even more than I did for it, you know?
And here's the reason why it's hard to understand this, because we all know people, maybe you are the person, who bought a growth-oriented company at way above, let me talk about intrinsic value for just a second. So give the difference between growth and value. A value company, if you take everything that it owns, all its facilities, all of its the value of its patents, all that good stuff, and you give it a number, and then you look at all of its debt, and you subtract the debt from the value of all of its assets, you have what you and I would call for ourselves a net worth. There are lots of names for it in the market. One of them is book value, but there's like three definitions of book value. There's the equity value. There's a lot of things, but underneath it all is an intrinsic value. This is what the stuff is worth if they shut down today and just sold their stuff. Okay. A growth company, if you took that same number, that intrinsic value.
Oh, wait a minute. You left something out.
Okay, go ahead.
It's a value company when you look at that intrinsic breakup
market
value, and you divide that by the number of shares outstanding. And if the number, and you get a price per share, and if the, let's say, let me give you a very simple example. If there was a company that was worth $1,000, it had 100 shares net worth, $1,000 or whatever you want to call it. It had 100 shares outstanding. The intrinsic value of those shares is $10. If they were selling for $8 a piece, then if you bought them at $8, you are buying a value stock.
Right. You look at it and say these things are worth $2 more than that.
If the shares are selling at $12 because the company is growing really fast and people think it's going to continue to grow really fast and they think in the future it'll be worth more than $12, that's a growth company.
And to give an example outside of the stock market to a real estate place, real assets are easier to understand. The difference is by going, you're living in Austin, you look up, and just up the road, the sweet old lady that's been living next to you for 20 years, wonderful friend, is deciding to downsize, go to an assisted living facility, and says, I don't know what I can get for this. Would you buy my property for $100,000? Now, you might try to convince her to ask for more because this is Austin and the prices have come up, but at some point you say, this is a great price and I'm going to get it, because it's way below the intrinsic value of the current real estate appraisals. That's a good idea. Now, the growth side of things is if you look out and there's a rumor that a road is going to be built through a pasture, and that pasture is going to become a great place to put a filling station. But the rumor hasn't been fully verified yet. There's all the steps are being taken, and maybe it's going to happen. It's got kind of a high probability, but they haven't decided on the exact route. And you went and you bought up all the land in that pasture at a higher price than it would normally go for, expecting the growth to come later. That's a growth. Now, you might have a good expectation of that, but if your expectation of that growth is there, so is the person that currently owns that pasture. So they're going to want more for the pasture than the typical intrinsic value. So you're making a bet that what you're buying, you know more about than the person you're buying from.
Well, there's some examples of that out there right now. Google and Amazon. Have either one of them actually turned a profit?
Google's got a profit,
okay.
Yeah. They've got a
Amazon,
nice profit, just not per share.
Amazon has never really turned a profit. Now, its revenues keep going up. It's buying new things that are probably going to be profitable in the future. It is an extremely high quality, as far as customer satisfaction is concerned, company.
And they make profits like occasional quarters. Most of the time, they have losses.
They really don't have much in the way of a profit margin. And it's basically they got to run really, really hard to stay ahead of potential competition like Alibaba. Now, do I think they're probably going to do it? Yeah, I think it is probably they have this huge goodwill out there. But the point is, Amazon is a growth stock because you're buying it not because the shares are worth less than the company, but because you expect
them to have a new way of making money in the future.
Right, that in the future at some point they're going to become really profitable, and other people will be willing, because people think so highly of Amazon, other people will be willing to pay more for the shares than you did.
And here's the key.
That's a growth company.
It is quite possible with a growth company on a one-off purchase to make a tremendous amount of money, but it is actually more likely to lose money. So the quite possible thing, where people go, I made a huge amount of money on a growth company, that's the reason why people think growth companies are good. But if you look at all growth companies as a whole, and you say, how many growth companies actually succeed versus fail? And what you find is the majority of them fail. And so if you make two decisions, it's likely that one of them is going to be wrong, and possible that the second one's going to be wrong too.
It's really, you know, when Yahoo came out, there was absolutely no question in anybody's mind, this is the future. It is the thing. When America Online was sending everybody CDs, everybody thought this is the future. They bought Time Warner using using only their shares, because there was no way they were going to be anything but ultimately uber successful. In both cases, they've been anything but successful recently.
Ayo, what?
And so the point is, I can't imagine what would cause Amazon to fall on its proverbial face.
Just like we couldn't imagine at the time what would cause AOL to fall on its proverbial face.
But I would feel a lot more comfortable if they were in a position where something they were doing was already massively profitable. But that's okay. It's a growth stock.
You know? And by saying all of that, we are not anti-growth. We believe in some cases growth needs to be part of a portfolio.
And we're certainly not anti-Amazon.
No. And, I mean, I use Amazon for a lot of stuff. So the idea, and literally stuff.
Now there you go using technical terms.
Right. The idea here is having a good balance and looking at history. Historically, it's a lot easier to make money in value because you're buying things that are worth more than what you pay for them.
Yeah, for example, and again, we're not recommending the stocks. Goldman Sachs is, you know, just a phenomenally profitable bank that, whether you like their morality or not, is likely to remain profitable and have huge profits now and forever. And they're selling at such a phenomenal discount to their intrinsic value. They're unpopular. But the bottom line to it is, who would think of Goldman Sachs as a value stock? It is. Now, we're not recommending you buy Goldman Sachs because they could blow up like anybody else, and they could blow up very quickly. The point is that if you buy a large diversified portfolio of value stocks managed by somebody who is very nimble and very quick at selling them when they hit, and they have a good discipline of selling them when they hit an appropriate price, your probability of success, based on all we know about history, is much higher than if you buy a portfolio of, for example, large cap growth stocks, where you're betting on the fact that somebody is a greater fool than you are.
Right. Yeah. So that, I think value and growth, there's been a guy won a Nobel Prize, Eugene Fama from University of Chicago. I won a Nobel Prize for a different subject. He should have won it for the other thing that he did, which is over the many years that he's been a professor, his undergrads, the people working on their bachelor's degrees and taking an econ class from him, thousands upon thousands of them, for their credit, have been required to dig through microfiche-type film and digitize the data we have going back through the 1800s on the stock market, on trades taking place and what values of those companies were, because we have them on microfiche and now it's available. And because of that, he came up with what's called a three-factor model. And number one is that value tends to outperform growth historically across any long length of time, and that the smaller value tends to do better than larger value. And there's a couple other factors in there, but I don't want to get too complex, and it would happen very quickly there. That concept of, now the next thing, we'll have to wait till next hour to discuss, but talking about variable annuities versus fixed annuities versus life insurance, it's a very important topic because it kind of fits into the third question of what's a good price to pay, and we'll get into that next hour because we really don't even have time to start it.
But they're very, very good questions, and there's very good answers to them, but they're not quite as simple as in many cases the media would have you think. And just in case you're wondering,
aren't we the media too? No, we're the media. So we would have them think, and maybe it's not as complicated as we as the media would have them
think
either.
So
there's a middle ground.
We're not really news media.
What are we?
We're commentary.
Okay. I think that we've been reporting on numbers that are in the news.
Certainly, but we are commenting on them at great length.
Right. We are expounding our opinion.
And I don't consider myself a medium.
Maybe we're editorialists. See,
singularly, it would be a medium.
Right. Yes. And are you a medium?
I hope not.
I think I'm a large.
But this is the Personal Wealth Coach, which also happens to be an investment advisory firm located in Salado, Texas, when we're not here in Temple on the radio. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, you're certainly welcome to do so. Voicemail on the weekends, voice people during the week, and it is 254-947-1111.
Or toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and listen to podcasts. You can read our philosophy. And you can email us, Jeff or Jake.
It's Radio 1400 KTAR.
You're still
serving Central Texas.